On the record. On News Talk.
With Pinergy, supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
Now, as you might have seen yesterday, the GAA took its moment in the decade of centenaries with a really stunning and very emotional and evocative remembrance of the events of Bloody Sunday a century ago yesterday. There was also a recent documentary in RTE, Bloody Sunday 1920. That was the contribution from the national broadcaster. And we all, I think, at this stage are much more familiar now with the story of Bloody Sunday than we were before. But there is one plot of the day, a raid on the Gresham Hotel, which is still almost a total mystery. There were two men killed there on Bloody Sunday, but even a century on, it's not clear whether they were spies or if they were just somehow unfortunate who ended up on the hit list for no fault of their own. And Donal Fallon is here to tell us all about the mystery of Bloody Sunday. Donal, thanks very much for joining us. It really was spectacular stuff in Croke Park last night, and I don't mean the football, I mean the event beforehand.
we won't talk about the football, but wasn't it an incredible thing? And, you know, historians, I think we aim for kind of some detachment from the past. I think that's vital to try and interpret it. But yesterday, my God, I mean, that was a day of high emotion. And the GAA, I think they just mastered the Bloody Sunday centenary. And they took the biggest challenge of the day. You know, the biggest challenge was the empty stadium. Mm. But they used it. You know, it became a kind of component of the commemoration of the 14 lives lost there a century ago. And it was something just deeply moving, wasn't it, about the empty ground, the 14 lights blazing in the corner. And the reading of the names and the biographies. And look, who could have done it like Brendan Gleeson did it? I think he just captured the occasion. And there was just, yeah, I mean, the names, Jerome O'Leary, 10 years of age. From a footballing point of view, we'll be gracious and say,
yeah, please do, move on.
7 minutes, yeah. That should be said. But in all seriousness, I mean, it was a serious show of strength from a Dublin team that some suggested maybe coming to the end of their reign of dominance. Maybe rumours of their demise have been greatly exaggerated. But like the GAA and with the assistance of the brilliant sports writer Michael Foley, wrote The Bloody Field, they've had a great year. I mean, they've had podcasts, historical videos, new memorial plaques at Parnell Park yesterday, a lot more besides. The aspect of the Bloody Sunday story is well covered now. Mm. But amazingly, there are still aspects of Bloody Sunday, which even at the remove of 100 years, a century, we know very, very little about, and around which there are still a lot of questions, like this story today. This moment of madness in the Gresham Hotel a century ago this weekend.
Yeah, just to go backwards a second, I think you're totally right about how the GAA mastered the circumstances that they had, because I remember being in Croke Park 5 years ago. I think there was an international rules match on. It was the 95th anniversary of Bloody Sunday then, and they had the little blazing bonfires in the corner of Hill 16 as well, but the stadium was pretty much full and you had to have the emergency lights on and it was a little bit better lit. I think they managed to completely master the solemnity of the occasion yesterday by having the house lights down completely. It was very, very impressive stuff. Most of the dead of Bloody Sunday, or at least certainly the Irish dead of Bloody Sunday, they're all buried in one place.
Yeah, visitors to Glasnevin Cemetery today, you can visit 14 of the graves of people that were killed on Bloody Sunday. And to put it in context, 32 people lost their lives that day. But most of the morning's dead would have been brought back to Britain, you know, the Secret Service agents and the like. So 14 of them in one place is quite remarkable. And in recent years, the GAA has really done its bit there, because they've marked the graves of the spectators who died in Croke Park, many of whom were in unmarked graves for, you know, 90, 95 years. Mm. It's a lovely little touch. But one of the Bloody Sunday dead, a guy called Lieutenant Leonard Aidan Wilde, who's at the heart of this kind of strange story today, is still buried in an unmarked grave in the very quiet St. Paul's section of Glasnevin. And I think this is the missing part of the Bloody Sunday story. I mean, for example, the brilliant RTE documentary, Bloody Sunday 1920. I mean, everyone was in it. Paul Rouse, particularly good. Great documentary. The death of these two men in the Gresham Hotel. It's just missing from the narrative, I suppose, because the story is so big, Bloody Sunday. There's so many components to the story. Something's always missing from the narrative. And, you know, for most of the last century, what happened in the Gresham Hotel has been that part of the tale.
Dreadful as Bloody Sunday was, with dozens, unfortunately, losing their lives in that day, amazingly, it wasn't quite as bloody as it was originally intended to be.
It could have been bloodier Sunday. You know, we know the days in terms of what came off, you know, where the shootings happened and not what didn't. Like, the intended number of hits that morning was significantly higher. There were actually, I think, 35 men on a hit list that morning. And on the day, things didn't quite go to plan. Like Todd Andrews, part of the Andrews dynasty, guiding light of Fianna Fáil, he was out that morning as a young IRA hitman sent to a house in Ranelagh. And their target, luckily for him, just wasn't home at the time. So this is, if you draw up a hit list of 35 men, they're not all going to be at home at any point of the day. And that's how it goes. And on the other side of the city, for whatever reason, a number of hits around the kind of North Circular Road, Phoenix Park, were just bungled. Either people weren't home or, you know, the IRA, the young volunteers in the day just bottled it. Mm. And Andrews, who was, you know, ever a straight talker, he said that The fact is, the majority of the raids were abortive. The men sought were not in their digs, or in several cases, the men looking for them bungled their jobs. So it could have been a much bigger operation than it was. But, you know, most of the firing on the day was done by the squad, a kind of crack team of young volunteers willing to engage in targeted assassinations. And they're young. Charlie Dalton, 17 years of age on the morning of Bloody Sunday, which is incredible. And then the older boys that are out that day, some of them 18, 19. And really, in the squad, you're a man at 20. And the way they talk about it years later with such detachment, I find it incredible. Vinnie Byrne said, "We were all young, 20, 21. We never thought we'd win or lose. We just wanted to have a go. We'd go out in pairs, walk up to the target, do it, then split. On a typical job, we'd use about 8, including the backup. Nobody got in our way. One of us would knock him over with the first shot and the other would finish him off with a shot to the head." I mean, there's a real detachment to how these lads remembered what they did. And because of their number, the squad earned this really unusual moniker. They were known as the 12 Apostles. You know, there were 12 men in the team, but they needed more than 12 men on the 21st of November 1920. So they bulked up, if you will, were kind of willing men from the Dublin Brigade.
Yeah, so they needed more hands on the day of the 21st of November 1920. Where did they get the extra support from?
And you know what? I've always pondered if the very fact that this thing happened suggests that British intelligence was perhaps not as strong as Michael Collins believed it was. Because this was the best-kept secret in Dublin. You know, on one level, you had dozens, if not maybe 100 people who knew that this was happening. You've got getaways. You've got safe houses. You've got a makeshift field hospital in case lads are injured. You've got lookouts. You know, you've got the young men carrying the revolvers, of course, as well. There's a lot of people who kind of know Bloody Sunday is coming, and yet the British don't have a sense of it at all. It was the best kept secret in town. And they maintain that element of surprise at 9 o'clock in the morning, exactly the same time across the city, they move into action. So, I mean, the 12 apostles, if you will, are on this day several dozen apostles, so to speak, men brought in from the ranks of the IRA, and 14 IRA men, without anyone from the squad, make their way into the Gresham Hotel under the stewardship of a guy called Paddy Moran. And the way the story's told by people that were there is brilliant. It's high drama. One of the volunteers talks about how our first job was to disconnect the telephone. We knew the rooms in which the intelligence agents were located. Our party split as prearranged and proceeded to the rooms allotted to them. I remained with Paddy while the shooting was taking place. There were people in the dining room and we took up position at the door and held them there. Like, imagine this. You've gone for your morning breakfast in the hotel. These 14 men walk in the door of the Gresham and say, you know, nobody move as they cut the telephone wires. You can almost imagine it.
Yeah, you mentioned the sense of drama that there was among the first-hand recounts. There are still some fairly dramatic accounts that survive, including from the guy who was managing the Gresham at the time.
Yeah, not a great day to be managing the Gresham Hotel, and not a great time to be managing a hotel in general, to be honest, during the midst of a revolution and right after the Spanish flu. But the manager at the Gresham, he talks about how 9 o'clock in the morning of Bloody Sunday, I'm in bed in my room and I'm awakened by a noise. It's a muffled sort of thing, like the beating of a carpet. It's actually gunshots, you know, in another part of the hotel. And the lads that were sent there, a few of them give witness statements later on, and they're just high drama. This guy, James Cahill, says the targets were wild in McCormick. We found McCormick's bedroom door closed but unlocked. Nick Leonard and I entered the room and moved towards McCormick, who was sitting up in bed. He fired. The bullet passed between Nick and myself, burying itself in the door. We fired almost in the same instant, killing him outright. And this guy, Cahill, ends his account of the Gresham shootings. I just find the last line amazing. He says, "As we emerged from the hotel, there was no enemy in view, and the usual Sunday morning calm prevailed in O'Connell Street." You know, like, imagine just walking out of the Gresham, having shot these two men, and it was like a normal Sunday in Dublin. Absolutely extraordinary.
Everyone going off to Mass in the Pro Cathedral the next street over, probably. The two men killed there, they had been in World War One and they had very different wartime experiences. But I suppose the big questions, and this is where the mystery emerges, is whether in fact the two men killed in the Gresham were actually spies.
These two bodies are lying on the floor at Gresham, McCormick and Wilde. And I mean, they're curious characters. Leonard Aidan Wilde, he's a World War One veteran. He's been dismissed with shell shock. Later works at a foreign office in Spain and then dismissed from his post there too. So he's not exactly the most trusted person. You know, he's been dismissed from the army, dismissed from the foreign office. The other guy, McCormick, is a veteran of the war, but he's been in the Army Veterinary Corps in Egypt. He's an athlete. He's a very respected jockey. And he's involved with the Alexandria Turf Club. And the hotel manager recounts afterwards, he'd been there since September. He'd been buying racehorses. That's why he was in Ireland. And although he was a veterinary surgeon with the British Army, it would appear to have been grave doubt as being associated with intelligence. While he was here, I never saw him receiving any guests. He slept well into the afternoon and only got up early when a race meeting was on. When I found him shot in his room, the Irish Field was lying beside him, you know, the racing post of the day. So, I mean, this was someone who, as far as the Gresham knew and as far as people who knew him knew, was basically in Ireland buying racehorses.
Yeah, and the second guy then, this gentleman Wilde as well, he left behind a fairly strange paper trail which suggested that, contrary to being some sort of subversive trying to undermine the Irish, that he might secretly have actually been on our side.
No one knew anything about this about Wilde. Some of the press in England pondered if he was related to Oscar Wilde, because he seemed like this kind of curious adventurer. But he seems to have been in Ireland on a rogue kind of one-man mission of peace, from what we can tell. And 3 days before he was killed, he writes to the Labour Party in Britain, and actually the letter is, you know, signed from the Gresham Hotel, saying that, you know, Ireland, what I'm seeing in Ireland is not British rule. Ireland will never be coerced. Ireland is essentially a country of tradition-loving people, and our traditions must be respected by those who govern her. And he basically says to the Labour Party in Britain, look, I'm in Ireland. I can give you first-hand accounts of what's happening here, and I believe there has to be justice in Ireland. So, yeah, rather than being a British Secret Service agent, it kind of seems this guy's sympathies are with the Irish, and he thought he could bring peace about in his own strange way. But we do know that when the IRA arrive into the hallway of the Gresham Hotel, he steps out of his room, sees them, panics, and says, Alan Wilde, Secret Service. But I think he probably thought he was looking at a police raid, you know, and he was telling them what he thought they wanted to hear.
Yeah,
so to speak.
That I'm establishment powers here. I'm not the guy who's a subversive. Yeah.
Exactly. I'm not who you're looking for. So there's no real evidence of this guy being a Secret Service agent. Rather, he seems like some kind of romantic maverick who thought he could answer the Irish question. And then McCormack, his mother, writes to the Irish state in 22, and her letter ends up on the desk of Michael Collins, Richard Mulcahy. And she basically says, as far as I'm aware, you know, my son was affiliated with the Alexandria Turf Club. He was buying horses. I know he'd been in the war, but he'd no connection to the Secret Service. And Collins basically admits it. He says to Mulcahy, with reference to this case, you remember that I stated on a former occasion, we'd no evidence he was a Secret Service agent. You know, as far as I know, some of the men killed were just regular officers. McCormack was one of them. And Collins basically tells Mulcahy, you know, right back to her, there's no particular charge against your son, but that he was an enemy soldier. So he expresses his sympathy, Mulcahy, with the heartbroken mother of McCormack. It seems like the revolutionaries were admitting, you know, 2 years later, that this guy, at least McCormack, was certainly not a spy.
Yeah, just treating him as something of collateral damage in a war, but not something that was ever targeted at all. I suppose even now, and with the midst of time, it's even harder to get to the bottom of it. We don't know quite what's up with these gentlemen of aggression, and we never will.
Maybe they were spies. You know, maybe they were so good.
Well, the guy introduced himself as Secret Service. Maybe he was a spy, you know?
Perhaps, you know, that there is no trail. Perhaps they were. That this is the great mystery of what happened in the Gresham Hotel.
What do you think?
It seems likely to me that McCormack and Wilde, you know, were more likely kind of curious men of mystery than spies. I think one was more concerned with horse racing and one was more concerned with this mission of peace that he felt he was on in his own head. And, you know, they both had a very checkered military past. I don't think it's surprising they ended up on people's radar that day. I mean, the IRA had eyes and ears in every hotel across the city. Curious characters like this would have been noticed. But I think they were probably just innocent, curious characters. And, you know, Wilde ultimately still buried in an unmarked grave in Glasnevin, where he remains today. So, yeah, in a city of kind of spies, espionage, counterintelligence, we might never know the full truth of what happened at the Gresham. But it is the real mystery of Bloody Sunday. And Michael Foley, what a brilliant book. The Bloodied Field, brilliant podcast of the same name. I mean, the minute by minute, we know what happened at Croke Park. And minute by minute, we know most of what happened that morning in the South Inner City. But what happened on O'Connell Street or Sackville Street, well, that's still a mystery.
Yeah, we will never perhaps know exactly what went on there, while so many other things were happening elsewhere in the city. Donald Fallon, thank you for talking us through that. As ever, really fascinating stuff. Donald Fallon, he is a historian. He's the author of the Come Here To Me books, and he's the presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast, which you'll find online.